Do you want to see what the face of Palestinian terror looks like? We'll talk about it right here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Paramedics in the West Bank try feverishly to revive the 13-year-old girl, allegedly stabbed in her own bedroom by a young Palestinian. Inside her home in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba, Israeli security forces find a scene of bloodshed. They say guards shot to death the assailant, a 17-year-old Palestinian from a nearby village. The girl was rushed to a Jerusalem hospital but was soon pronounced dead, the latest victim in 8 months of heightened violence between Palestinians and Israelis.
13 years old, sleeping in her bed at home. All of you parents, all of you grandparents with kids that age, just think about it. Little girl, 13 years old, sleeping in her own bed, stabbed to death by a 17-year-old Palestinian terrorist. And Palestinian leadership is celebrating. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and we must report on this horrific event. And we must remind you that this is the face of Palestinian terror. And this is the mindset that many Palestinians have, which is the Israelis must be killed. The Israelis are guilty. The Israelis need to die, especially if they're living in a settlement, even if you're a 13-year-old girl sleeping in your own bed. Tragic, friends, tragic. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. If you believe that Israel is the guilty party, that Israel is somehow the evil occupier, that Israel is an apartheid state, that Israel is guilty of genocide, go ahead, give me a call and prove your point on a day like today. Go ahead and argue your point on a day like today. Those of you who refuse to recognize the evils of Palestinian terrorism and the fact that this will not accept some peaceful solution for everyone to coexist side by side, but this ultimately wants the extermination of the Jewish people, or at the very least, the expelling of the Jewish people from all of the land of Israel. Nothing less is the ultimate goal. Go ahead and give me a call on a day like today. The young girl, Halel Yafe Ariel, our oldest granddaughter, 15, two grandsons, 12, granddaughter, 9. So our grandkids are all around that 13-year age on either side of it. Some of you right now driving back from school with a 13-year-old sitting next to you in the car about to pick them up. This is the madness. This is the horror that Israel deals with every day. And if not for the heightened security that Israel lives by, it's perfectly safe walking around Israel. In fact, it's far safer than just getting in the car and driving to work in terms of potential of a casualty. But that's only because of day and night vigilance. That is only because Israel stops the potential onslaught of hundreds and hundreds of attacks on a monthly basis. And as reported on PALWatch.org, the PA and Fatah quick to honor the murderer who killed the 13-year-old in her sleep. The mother of the terrorist told the local Hebron News Network that her son was a hero who made her proud. What kind of mother is proud of a 17-year-old boy that kills a 13-year-old girl in cold blood in her sleep? What kind of mother? She said, "My son is a hero. He made me proud. My son died as a martyr, defending Jerusalem in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds. He, my son, has joined the martyrs before him, and he is not better than them. Allah willing, all of them will follow this path, all the youth of Palestine, Allah be praised." And of course, this myth that this is about defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was in danger, the same lie gets circulated and Israelis die.
fire we
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
عرفنا اليوم لماذا يبنون الجدران ليس لمنع الصواريخ وإنما لمنع الذبح عن رقابهم يا أخي في الضفة اطعن المرحلة الأولى يا رجال الضفة من تنفيذ العملية.
Well, if you don't understand Arabic and I don't follow spoken Arabic, I have to read it to understand it. The imagery is absolutely shocking. I've seen the footage of it there. It comes from October of last year in Gaza, an imam preaching in the mosque with knife in hand, calling for the stabbing of the Jewish people. The world must hear, he said, via these cameras and via the internet, this is Gaza. This is the place of trenches and guns. This is the West Bank. This is the place of bombs and daggers. This is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the code word. The soldiers of the Prophet Muhammad are here. Brothers, this is why we recall today what Allah did to the Jews. We recall what he did to them in Khaybar. He said, invoking the slaughter of the Jewish residents of Khaybar by the marauding armies of the founder of Islam, Muhammad. And on he goes, my brother in the West Bank, stab. My brother in the West Bank, stab the myths of the Talmud in their minds. My brother in the West Bank, stab the myths about the temple in their hearts. Today we have declared a curfew in Israel, he gloated. Listen to what the Jews are saying to one another. Stay at home or go outside to your death. They have no alternative. O men of the West Bank, the first phase of the operation requires stabbing in order to bring about a curfew. This is the knife intifada. This is the method has been used. Random stabbing of Jewish people. This morning, a 13-year-old girl asleep in her bed. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you have any Jewish-related question of any kind, any Israel-related question of any kind whatsoever, any Hebrew-related question, any messianic prophecy type question, anything along those lines you want to ask, the phone lines are always open on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. Even Islamic-related questions, we're glad to take your calls. You might say, Mike, it's terrible. It's tragic. It's absolutely horrific. no question whatsoever this is evil, but it's a vicious cycle. Israelis kill Palestinians. Palestinians kill Israelis. That's just the reality. No. Please don't paint a picture like that at a time like this. It is certainly not accurate. Why do I say that? Because this hatred of the Jewish people in Islam predates the establishment of the modern state of Israel. When Jews and Arabs were living side by side in the 1930s, and there was plenty of room for everyone, and there was no modern state of Israel yet established, and the Jews were developing the land, and more Arabs were moving back to take advantage of that land development, and other Arabs had lived there before, and other Jews in lesser numbers had lived there before as well, it was then that intifadas were launched against the Jews. It was then that the attacks came against the Jewish people. And Hitler was able to draw on some of the Jew hatred that was already found in Islamic traditions by way of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the one who launched intifadas against the Jewish people in the 1930s. So these sentiments have existed before. A famous hadith, so authoritative Islamic tradition, saying the end will not come until the Muslims fight against the Jews, meaning fight against them and destroy them. And when Muhammad was rejected as the last great prophet by the Jewish tribes that he encountered, by the Jewish people that he encountered, that bred some of the hostility towards the Jews that is found in Islam. So let's not just make this like, well, tit for tat. No, let's recognize that even this recent incitement to violence is based on complete falsehoods, based on the idea that the Al-Aqsa Mosque was going to be defiled. It's a lie that's put out over and over. And then Palestinians, in honor of Islam, are outraged, and they're now going to go on a killing spree. It's absolutely, absolutely horrific. I hope you can join me in Israel next year. First, our tours are perfectly safe, of course. It's not that you go into some risky area to defy death or something like that. Let me say, if you get in your car to drive to work, you risk an accident more than you risk a problem happening on a tour as we're together in Israel. But a great way to show solidarity with Israel is to go on one of these tours. And then more importantly, to get a heart for the Jews and the Palestinians by being on one of our tours. I really do hope you could make it. It is life-changing and life-impacting. And you'll know as you go. Again, to find out more, go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Let's show our solidarity with the people of Israel. Let's pray for the bereaved family. Let's pray for the shocked Israelis. And let's pray for mercy on the Palestinians. They are fed lies. They have elected corrupt leaders. The corrupt leaders have made things only worse for them. If they were living at peace with Israel, their standard of living would be night and day different. So in that sense, it's a vicious cycle. And Israel is far from perfect in its dealings with the Palestinians. But I can assure you that their intentions as a national government are to work out ways to peacefully coexist, as opposed to how can we exterminate the Palestinians, whereas, say, Hamas, the leadership of Gaza, their goal remains the same, to exterminate the Jewish people out of the land of Israel. And the Palestinian Authority does not lag much behind in terms of its anti-Israel sentiment. So, as reported on PALWatch.org today, both the Palestinian Authority and Fatah called the murderer of the 13-year-old girl today in Israel, killed in her sleep by a 17-year-old Palestinian terrorist. They have branded him already a shaheed, a martyr, because he was shot to death following the attack. And earlier this week, a Palestinian media watch reported that Mahmoud Abbas's advisor, Sultan Abu al-Anayn, said, "Every place you find an Israeli, cut off his head." God have mercy. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's take some calls right now. We'll start in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Josiah, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. I guess my question I wanted to ask you about is the dietary laws. I've been talking to other Christians who are Seventh-day Adventists, so when I talk to them about the kind of foods that I eat, they often tell me, well, no, you can't eat that and this and that. Then when I tell them about Mark 7 or Acts 10, they'll tell me that those are just, visions. One is just talking about the hand. So I want to know how you dealt with that.
Sure thing. Acts 10 is a vision that God gave to Peter, using food to illustrate that he could bring the message to the Gentiles. It was not telling him to go and eat non-kosher food. But Seventh-day Adventists have real problems with a number of things. Jesus cooks fish for his disciples in the Gospel of John, the last chapter of the Gospel of John, which is problematic if everyone was only vegetarian. We know that Abraham was a meat eater, and Israelites were meat eaters. It's just that they wouldn't eat certain foods. So some Seventh-day Adventists are complete vegetarians. Others just go by the dietary laws. But their other problem is, why just those laws? Why do they keep those laws and not other laws of purity? Why do they keep the Ten Commandments and the dietary laws, but they don't observe the biblical calendar? Why do they observe those laws and not other civil laws? So it's really a breakdown. There's no logic behind it whatsoever. And what the New Testament does indicate to us, Josiah, is that no food in and of itself defiles. What defiles is what comes out of our heart. That's in Matthew 15 or Mark 7. So what comes out of our heart, evil intents and thoughts, that's what makes us unclean. But the food, whether we're eating with washed or unwashed hands or the particular food we eat, that doesn't defile our inner being. And that's why that's reiterated Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians, the 8th chapter, indicating that it was fine for these Gentile believers to eat food that was sold in the marketplace, meat that was sold in the marketplace. It was probably offered to an idol at some point. And then after that, because the idol didn't actually eat it, then it's sold in the marketplace. But Paul said, look, if you don't know it, it doesn't matter. If you don't know it, don't make an issue out of it. If someone says, hey, this was offered to an idol, then don't eat it for the sake of that person. But basically what we need to say is, number one, why do you keep just these laws and not all the others? Where does the Torah make that distinction? Number two, for those who are totally vegetarian, what do you do with Jesus cooking fish for his disciples? And number three, what do you deal with the New Testament teaching that nothing that you eat in and of itself defiles you? I don't eat pork or any foods that are forbidden in the Torah, but there is no mandate in the New Testament for believers to do that, in particular for Gentile believers. Josiah, also, if you go to my website, AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org, just search in the digital library for dietary laws, and you'll see I address that in an online teaching video as well. All right, got a break. Thank you, sir, for the call. Hey, this is Michael Brown. I want to invite you to join me for our second ever trip to Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. This is a great opportunity. I get to interact with you, our radio listening audience, and our ministry partners as we experience the land of Israel together, and it will be a life changer. We've got a great price on the trip, and if you're one of our monthly supporters or torchbearers, you're eligible to receive a special discount for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. Space is limited. We're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip to secure your spot, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Israel banner, or call our office at 704-782-3760.
Oh, God of burning, cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, NBC News says a suspected terrorist, Palestinian terrorist, 17 years old, murders a 13-year-old girl sleeping in her bed. NBC says suspected terrorist. Immediately hailed by Palestinian leadership as a martyr, his mother hailing him as a martyr, Shahid, proud of him for his murderous act. And NBC's initial report, suspected terrorist. And the voice of that little girl you heard is a little girl holding a knife talking about how she wants to stab a Jew as her father commends her. These little children are being polluted with anti-Israel, anti-Jewish hatred. They're being polluted with lies from their earliest days. And they get so angry and upset, they just want to go kill a Jew. How demonic, how ugly, how despicable. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Burke, Virginia. Matthew, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. You had asked if anybody had a view that it's Israel's fault, it's Israel's government's fault that this happened. They came into the land. They didn't clear out the land like God had commanded them to do in the Torah. They allowed this evil to exist. They allow this wicked, evil religion to be preached among their population out on loudspeakers every day. They allow the radio stations to play this propaganda, the TV stations to play this propaganda from Ramallah and from Gaza. And when you invite evil into your country and you allow it to sit there and permeate, this is what you're going to get. This is what we have here in the United States.
All right, but Matthew, hang on for a second. God did not command Israel today to murder the Palestinians, to murder the Muslims. He didn't command them to do that or to wipe them out. There was a one-time thing with the Canaanites. It waited centuries and centuries because God said in Genesis 15, the iniquity of the Amorites had not yet reached its full measure, all right? And when it did, then God said exterminate them, men, women, and children. It was an extreme act, but that was the one time in history that Israel was called to do that. Israel
came back to... But didn't in the Torah it also say that you're to put this wickedness out from out of your tent, from out of your camp, from out from among you.
That was when the Israelites had sin in their own midst. When the Israelites had sin in their own midst, when Israelites were guilty of sin, they were to deal with it radically. But they were not to go to the surrounding nations and try to wipe them out once they were established in the land. And you have to remember also, Matthew, Israel was expelled from the land because of its own sin. And Israel was brought back into the land by the mercy of God. There were a lot of atheists and secular Jews that were involved.
It doesn't mean that you keep the evil among you.
But Matthew, it's not up to Israel to go wipe out the Palestinians. Then you're no better than Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. You're no better than them. You're saying wipe them all out. You're no better than what they're doing.
I didn't say wipe them out. I said remove them from the land.
Okay,
you don't need to give the land up to them or allow them to propagate.
But Matthew,
why is there a TV station in Gaza being allowed to broadcast this garbage?
Because it's under Hamas. Gaza is run by Hamas, and it's their choice to do what they want to do. There are obviously consequences. Israel is not going to allow for Hamas to prosper doing that. But Matthew, it's not up to Israel now to drive out every Arab from the land. The goal is to live peacefully side by side. And if there is a necessity for war, then you fight. And then if you have to take territory, you take territory.
But here's the thing, okay?
Matthew, listen to me for 1 second, all right? Israel is not a nation that is righteous in God's sight today, okay? Israel cannot say that they are going to expel the evil when Israel has its own evil, when Israel has its own problems and sins and issues. Israel is in the land today by the mercy of God. And it is not God's will for Israel to destroy all the Palestinians, to drive out every Arab. That there was the conquest under Joshua. It does not say you repeat that through the generations. And I can guarantee you this, if Israel was to do what you wanted Israel to do, Israel would become a complete pariah, rightly so, to the whole world. And Israel, it would be the end of Israel. Not even America would stand with Israel if it were to do that. And God would not stand with Israel for doing that either.
But what peace can you have with a people whose religion says to kill every single Jew, and when the last Jew is arrived, the rocks and the trees will cry out, come kill them? Their very resurrection and salvation is based upon the destruction of the Jewish people.
Understood.
So how can you have peace with that when their very religion and their very faith to the core is stating to kill every single Jew?
Because not every Muslim believes that, and there are plenty of more secular Muslims that don't believe that. And for the most part, there are others who, especially the younger generation, that basically just wants to live peacefully. But Matthew, here's the deal. Of course, there will not be a true lasting peace before the Messiah comes. But the idea that they want to exterminate us, so we'll exterminate them, or they want to drive us out, so we'll drive them out, all that's going to do is exacerbate the war. It's going to make things worse and worse and worse. But hey, I asked for phone calls and you called in. I appreciate the fact that radical Islam is radical and is murderous and under no circumstances will dwell in a lasting, peaceful way with Israel. And it's a massive problem. But the solution is not to drive out all the Arabs and the Muslims. That's not the solution. But Matthew, thank you for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. I'm going to keep taking calls for the next 90 minutes. And in the second hour, going to have a guest on that's going to talk about reaching Muslims with the gospel. Hey, friends, go to the website, AskDrBrown.org. Make plans to join me in Israel next year and check out our special resource offer and my latest article on the stream, why I'm actually rooting for Donald Trump. What? Read it.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish-related question of any kind that you have, by all means, give me a call, and we'll do our best to give you a solid scriptural answer. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go back to the phones in Brooklyn. Yvonne, welcome to the line of fire.
Thank you. Dr. Brown, what I was thinking, I'm not really sure, but I was thinking that when you talked about the 17-year-old, I'm wondering, are these people more than just Muslims? They're just kind of demonic under the hood of Muslims, because, I mean, the thing is, okay, how he did it was more over and beyond. I mean, you know, the person couldn't even defend themselves. And then next, the woman, I mean, his woman, the mother was applauding, but I don't know. I think the woman might be under duress right now, because I'm looking, and if she didn't say it, she would have been the same way, because I don't think he had a conscience. Really, and then I'm looking, you know, even within our setting, that all of the women, everywhere you go, there's a flock of women wearing their head coverings now. So I think, you know, the women have to seem like they're under subjection and do whatever the men say. I don't know if the men, the women are the same as the men and the children, but I think the behind it is like they don't want the spread. It's Jesus versus, really, Jesus versus Satan.
Yvonne, let me give you a few responses. Certainly, it's demonic, it's satanic. Anytime someone murders another person, cold-blooded murder, there's something demonic about that. Satan is the father of lies and has been a murderer since the beginning. So for sure, there's always something demonic about it. There's something demonic about a 17-year-old just killing a 13-year-old girl in her bed just because she's an Israeli. But and for the mother to react like that, there may be some level of shock, but genuinely, they are so brainwashed that they believe that this is the path to martyrdom, that this is doing a good thing. They have so much hatred for the Israelis. There is so much demonizing of the Israelis in their minds. You have to remember, once you dehumanize another people, once you look at them as less than human, once you look at them as the sons of monkeys and pigs, as Quranic thought does about the Jewish people, once you have then suffered some level of hardship and you attribute it to them, it's at their expense. There were Nazi murderers who went home and played with their children. And if their little girl cut her knee, oh, they were so tender and they were gentle towards their wives. And then they go to the concentration camps and slaughter Jews. It's what happens when you dehumanize. When whites dehumanized blacks and bought them in slave trade, and well, they're just different and they're not on the same level. This is a horrific thing that happens in history, and it leads to brutality and bloodshed in the most despicable way. It's just when it happens like this, it tears more deeply at all of our hearts. And Prime Minister Netanyahu is rightly calling for the world to outright condemn this unconditionally and for Palestinian leadership to unconditionally condemn it. Will it happen in a true way from Palestinian leadership? I say no, because I say that they're behind the incitement that leads to this. There's no question that they're behind the larger incitement that leads to this. And when you glorify these people, when you turn them into martyrs, when you give the families stipends for life or a cash bonus, when a family member kills Jews, no way are they going to condemn it from the heart. We'll be right back.
Send it, Lord. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We go to Larry on Long Island. Thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
How are you, Dr. Brown?
Hey.
Listen, I'm outraged about this girl. I mean, just outraged. And I know the Bible tells me that God says that the Jews are the apple of his eye. He loves them, and he never divorced them. Now, we go into the New Testament, and Paul says we're grafted in. And we're part of the root. So therefore, we have a direct fellowship and love, supposedly, for the Jews. If that be the case, biblically, I'm asking, rather than nonviolence, as you say, we shouldn't go, how do or where does our preachers tell their congregations to scream out in outrage, whether with telegrams or whatever, to these people worldwide, not just from the United States, because there's Christians in every part of the world. In the deepest, darkest places of Africa, there's Christians. And how do we get the message out that we have to support them, if not by arms, because I'm willing to pick up arms at this point, but then where biblically does it say we should defend them?
Yeah, well, Larry, first, I appreciate your sentiments, of course, and share your outrage, and the pain we feel is obviously a fraction of what people in Israel are feeling, and the family is feeling. Again, who can imagine these things? And Israel is glad to say that although they receive a hefty amount of financial help from the United States for its defense, that Israel's not asking anyone to come and die on its soil to defend them. But for sure, we are all called to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and that means for God's intervention in the Muslim world as well, and for repentance and mercy to be poured out in the Muslim world as well. For sure, when it comes time to vote, we vote for leaders who will stand strongly for Israel. I have a grid before I'll consider voting for a candidate in a major office. I have a grid that I'm looking at, and just for me, there are three things I look at first. First, are they pro-life? Second, are they pro-marriage and family? And third, are they pro-Israel? Now, by being pro-life, you care about the mothers that are going to abort their babies as well, but because you're pro-life, you stand for the life of that child and to help that mother. When we're pro-marriage and family, we don't hate the homosexual community, but we will not redefine marriage and things like that. When we're pro-Israel, we want the good of the Palestinians as well, but we recognize that God has brought the Jewish people back to the land, recognize that they're our number one ally in the Middle East and the truest democracy in the Middle East and the one that's really wanting peace with its neighbors. So we can vote accordingly. Vote for candidates that will stand with Israel. When President Obama was running for president, when he was Senator Obama, I warned then that he would be the most radically pro-abortion, pro-homosexual candidate we had, and I had grave concerns about where he stood with Israel. Sadly, those concerns have proved true. He's not been an enemy of Israel, but this has been the coldest relationship between president and prime minister in my memory. We've got to do better with the next election, and may God help us there. But let us pray. Let us show solidarity. Let's go over to Israel. It's a great way to show solidarity. Trust me, it makes a difference to the people of Israel, to the nation of Israel, when you go over there on tours, when you spend time in the land, when you understand the people and the culture and the background even more. And we call on our elected officials to do what's right when it comes to Israel, and pray for Christians worldwide to stand together. Thank you, sir, for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. On this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, we go to Fort Mill, South Carolina. Bill, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
Dr. Brown?
Yes.
Yes, I'm interested in asking you about the Aramaic controversy. If the original manuscripts of the Gospels were in Aramaic, or if the epistles were in Aramaic. I know one man who's translating the Bible, a new translation, and he's very strong on the Aramaic controversy, and said that recent scholarship, the last 5-10 years, has come down on the side of Aramaic.
Yeah, that's
being the language.
Yep, that's so. Let's sort that out. And a lot of that is very much overstated. Here's what we do know. We know that all of the early manuscripts we have of the New Testament, every single one of them, the earliest manuscripts are in Greek. That's what we do have, number one. We do know that the great bulk of the New Testament was originally written in Greek. For example, when Paul was writing his letters to Greek-speaking people, he was writing in Greek. When other letters are being written to those where Greek is the lingua franca, the universally used language, they're written in Greek. From everything we can tell, all of the Gospels, that as we have them, originally written in Greek, although it's possible that there was an original composition of Matthew of the sayings of Jesus, and those sayings of Jesus were originally in Hebrew or in Aramaic. There are scholars, a whole camp, that says you have to go back to a Hebrew original. They would point to statements by some of the church fathers that speak of a compilation of the sayings of Jesus by Matthew in Hebrew, that would speak of the letter of Hebrews being written in Hebrew. As late as Jerome, there is a reference to him actually seeing some of these documents written in Hebrew. So we have that evidence. Then there are others who say, no, whenever it says Hebrew, it actually means Aramaic. And there's an argument that can be made for that. In other words, the language that was spoken by the Jewish people at that time, which would have been Aramaic more likely than Hebrew as the more commonly spoken language. And we do have the translation from the Greek into Aramaic called the Peshitta. This is a translation. This is not the original Aramaic. This is a translation, perhaps a century or two after the New Testament, of the Greek New Testament translated into Aramaic, just as the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Aramaic. The Peshitta is the Old and New Testament together translated into Aramaic. There is a new movement emphasizing an Aramaic original, claiming that, well, look, the disciples, Jesus would have all taught in Aramaic, so the original documents were in Aramaic. There's a strong movement that remains saying, no, no, it was originally in Hebrew. Hebrew is much more widely used than people think. There is a reference in the Talmud to some Hebrew Gospels, and that would most likely mean Hebrew there, not Aramaic. But again, we have no attestation of this. We have nothing in our hands. Any Hebrew Matthew we have is many, many centuries later. Brian Simmons, in his Passion Translation, is relying on the Aramaic a lot and feeling that scholars didn't use it adequately. I studied this in great depth, Bill, some years ago. And what we do know is that there is a strong Semitic background to the Greek New Testament. For example, the phraseology of the book of Revelation, the Greek grammar, resembles very much Hebrew grammar of the Old Testament. We know that some of the teachings of Jesus, if you reconstruct them in Hebrew or Aramaic, may have word plays or may have certain nuances that you don't get in the Greek. So scholars are aware of that, and top New Testament scholars look at these issues. But what has been preserved for us, sir, is in Greek. And from what we know, the great bulk, if not virtually all of the New Testament, was originally written in Greek. Now, if we found ancient Hebrew manuscripts or ancient Aramaic manuscripts, of parts of say Matthew or the sayings of Jesus, they were in Hebrew, they were in Aramaic, and this was an original, that would be an awesome find. But right now we have nothing, and what's been preserved is in Greek. So we certainly look at the Aramaic for insight, but not in the primary way. And I discuss this in brief in my book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. I have a question: was the New Testament originally written in Hebrew? Was the New Testament originally written in Aramaic? I give the arguments. I link to some a lengthy academic paper I wrote on this years ago, an article I wrote on this, and that's in 60 questions Christians ask about Jewish beliefs and practices. So right now, best thing that we still work with is the Greek New Testament, looking to the Hebrew and looking to the Aramaic for background and insight, but not in a primary way. Again, I answer that as well in 60 questions Christians ask about Jewish beliefs and practices. I've got a break right here. I've got to run, but thank you, sir, for an important question.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That is the audio from a children's presentation, a childhood festival. An Israeli soldier is captured. This is at a Khan Yunis childhood festival. So someone dressed up as an Israeli soldier. And that young Palestinian girl, which he's saying is, hurry up, my child, and join the battle. Die as a martyr and blow up the enemies. Palestine, an Arab clasping victory in one hand and stones of fire in the other. An Arab filled with challenge, pride, and resolve. Die as a martyr. Blow up the enemies. This is what little children are hearing. And this is the call for a knife revolution. A knife revolution. Joey, grab clip number two. This is Corey Gilschuster and his YouTube channel, Ask. And he's talking with Palestinians about stabbing soldiers and civilians. We'll start with number two.
What's his opinion about the people who stab and run over soldiers?
Yeah, are they heroes?
Halim Abdal Birayak?
Oh,
yes, of course they're heroes.
And if they kill someone who's a civilian or a settler, is it also good?
Yes, of course he is a hero, because in the end he is killing people who have taken away his land.
Yep. So these people stole the land. That's the narrative and understanding. They stole the land, so even to kill a civilian is a good thing. Well, let's hear from some more. We'll play one more clip. This is an extended clip. Clip number three next.
The people who die for their lands are heroes for us, because they are defend of their children, and the soldiers themselves are the most terrorists in our lands.
How do you know that the soldier that you stab is the same one who did something to you? How do you know?
Because he took my lands here.
What? So because he's Jewish?
Yeah. Not because we, as Muslims, are in no conflict with the Jewish of themselves. We are in conflict with the terrorists. Okay.
How do you know who's a terrorist and who's not a terrorist?
Because he came to our lands to take, to confiscate my wealth and to take my lands.
But how do you know he did it? If I live in Tel Aviv or in Haifa, and I'm Israeli and a Jew or a Zionist, and I didn't take anything from anybody, why should I be killed?
Because you came to my land. When one is an Israeli, he can find his roots. He is not from this land. So he knows that very, very well, that he is not from Palestine, that he deserves to be killed in our lands.
He knows
because,
that?
Yes.
Okay.
He deserves that. I think...
So any Israeli?
An Israeli, yes.
Any Israeli, yes. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the view, tragically. That's the view. And you're guilty, you came to confiscate my land, as opposed to we came to all live together in the land, and we helped develop the land so that everyone could prosper, and there's room enough for everyone to live together. Very, very sad. 866-34-TRUTH on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We'll go to Fort Mill, South Carolina. John, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, how are you? Yeah, I just have three really quick questions. Where did the name Palestine come from, and who were the first inhabitants, and when did the Jews first come to Palestine?
Sure thing. I appreciate the question. Yep. Okay, number one, the name Palestine came from the name Philistines. And with the second Jewish revolt under Bar Kokhba, 132 to 135 of this era, when that revolt was put down and Jewish people exiled out of Jerusalem, the Roman emperor, to mock the Jewish people and to make this feel even more foreign to them, renamed it Palestine based on the Philistines. So based on a foreign enemy, that's how it was renamed. So it was renamed to mock and disparage the Jewish people and to further say this is not your land. And that's how it was known through the centuries, Palestine. But that's where it started. The original inhabitants of the land, if you go back to the days of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you had Amorites, you had Hittites, you had different peoples living there, Canaanites, different peoples living in the land. Arabs did not come until centuries later. And the so Abraham, about 2000 BC, so a little over 4,000 years ago, comes to settle in the land, and God promises he'll give it to his offspring. And then generations later, when under Moses and Joshua, the children of Israel conquer the land, drive out and destroy the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Girgashites and the others that were living there, those that are called Palestinians today come along much, 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 much later in history. They did not exist as a people back at that earliest time, or as a people living in the land. They come much later in history, and so the Jewish people have the much earlier claim, of course, before that.
But is Palestine, I mean, is it actually a country, or was it a country?
Well, it was territory under Rome. It was territory under Rome. It was never just an independent ruled country that had its own flag and its own currency or anything like that. During times of Muslim rule, it was considered part of Syria, but it was under different rule over periods of time. And once the Jewish people were exiled from it, there was no sense of nationhood, like we are the Palestinian people. That concept arose after Israel recovered the land. That's when the idea of this being a Palestinian, this is our land, the Palestinian people, that's when it came up. So there were Arabs who were living there for generations, some for centuries, and in smaller number, there were Jews who were living there through centuries. There was always a Jewish presence through the centuries. But the idea that there's a Palestinian people, that's a modern myth. There are Arabs who were living there, but they either considered themselves part of Greater Syria or had their relations more in what would be Jordan today. And it wasn't until, some say, the Six-Day War in 67 that people began to actively talk about a Palestinian people. And that was really a propaganda ploy to work against Israel. Yes, there are Arabs living there, but they were not identified as a Palestinian people. Hey, John, we're out of time, but thank you for the question. Much appreciated. Friends, you'll find a lot of answers to a lot of questions on the website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Videos and articles that deal with lots of these issues, a link to our Jewish outreach website, a link to our Line of Fire archives, all at Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. And be sure to go to the stream, stream.org, check out my latest article. You got to read it. Don't just go by the title. You got to read it. Why I'm actually rooting for Donald Trump. Maybe, just maybe, the words of the godly Christian leaders Trump surrounded himself with will sink in even just a little bit. Be sure to check out the special resource offer with an exclusive from us at AskDrBrown.org. My bottom line today, pray for the Jewish people living in the land. Pray for mercy and for a turn towards the Messiah and for an outpouring in the Muslim world. You're about to get some fascinating insights on Islam on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. We've spent a good part of the last hour talking about horrific act of Palestinian terror this morning. 17-year-old Palestinian boy murdering a 13-year-old Israeli girl in cold blood while she slept in her bed. I encourage you to listen to some of the discussions, some of the things we talked about, some of the clips we played. Go to lineoffireradio.com later today, and you can listen to the first hours. It will be archived. If you subscribe by podcast, you will be getting it automatically. We'll be changing subjects in the second hour. I'm going to be speaking with Christian apologist and scholar Jonathan McClatchy about Islam and about evangelizing Muslims. We'll be talking about that, among other things, and taking your calls. Number to call, 866-348-7884. 866-34-TRUTH. But I want to go straight to the phones and take one call before we get to our guests. So Paul in Braintree, Massachusetts, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to mention one thing. It's so sad to hear about what happened this morning, and I will pray for the girl and her family, and even pray for the person who did it, because Lord have mercy on their soul. But one thing that jumped out at me is that when the Palestinians, when they were talking in the audios, it was all about, one thing that jumped out at me was, my land, our land, our land. And from what I gather from the Holy Gospel is that it's God's land, and they're claiming it to be theirs.
Yeah, but it's understandable. Land? Yeah, it's understandable, but that's not going to be their perspective. In other words, they're saying this is their ancestral heritage. In their mind, you know, their families lived there for generations, so that then backs up as if it's always been theirs. And, you know, look, if someone breaks into your house, you'd say, hey, this is my house, you know, or don't touch my family. They're saying it in that same way. You know, this is my land. But it's this myth, though, that they've always lived there. You know, they say they predate the Israelites, and it's this complete reconstruction of history. For sure, they suffered upheaval with the establishment of the modern state of Israel. But the upheaval was only suffered because decades earlier or years earlier, they had refused a very generous arrangement, whereas Jews had come back in the land, many people moving in. They were developing the land, many more Arabs then moving in consequently, and the population growing, that there was going to be a two-state solution with the great majority of the land going to the Arabs. And they said, no. So
I remember that deal was on the table. Yes.
Yeah, and so that was then refused, and then the second arrangement was not as good for them. But the partition plan in 1947, the Jews again said fine. I mean, they said fine to the first one. They said fine to the second one, and even with that, there could have been in 1948 the beginning not just of an Israeli state but of a Palestinian state. And if that's what it would have been called, who knows what it would have been called at that point. But there'd be side by side, there they exist. If not for the fact that Muslim leadership said no to the Jews in the land. That's the fundamental issue. It does not mean Israel's perfect. It means the great issue was Muslims saying no to a Jewish presence in the land and to a Jewish Jerusalem. That meant war. That was an affront to Allah. That was an affront to Islam. And it remains an affront to Islam and affront to Allah in Islamic thinking, hence the perpetual war against Israel and tragedies like this morning. All right, we'll be right back with Jonathan McClatchy as we focus on Islam on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today. I've had some great interaction with Jonathan McClatchy. He's been on The Line of Fire previously. I joined him on an apologetics broadcast he does from England and talked about Messianic prophecy. Ended up having some interesting interaction with a Muslim apologist. Jonathan is a Christian writer, international speaker, and debater, holds a bachelor's degree with honors in forensic biology, a master's degree in evolutionary biology, and a second master's degree in medical and molecular bioscience. Currently, Jonathan is a PhD student in cell biology. I can guarantee you in the very first class that Jonathan had in college, his very first class in forensic biology, he already knew more biology than I know today. No, I guarantee you that. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to The Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Brown, for having me.
So someone with an academic focus like this and PhD student in cell biology, I mean, obviously a very, very specific focus in your work. How do you end up dealing with issues like Islam?
Well, that's a great question. As I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, I began to interact more so than before with people of the Muslim faith, as well as people of other religious traditions and worldview persuasions, and began to attend the various, they called it the Islamic Awareness Week back then. They tend to call it the Discover Islam Week, but it's basically every university campus in the UK pretty much has an annual week of Islamic awareness, or as they call it, the Discover Islam Week, where they basically try to promote the Islamic religion and try to clarify stereotypes about Islam and Muslims. And so I've made a habit of attending those at the various universities I've attended. I've attended three universities to date, and just getting into interactions with Muslims and encountering the common objections that they have to the Christian faith, as well as the common polemics that they put out in favor of the Muslim worldview, such as, you know, the prophecies about Muhammad in the Bible, or the fact that, you know, no one's produced anything like the literary quality of the Quran. And so this testifies to its divine origin, or the numerous scientific miracles in the Quran, or and so forth that Muslims use to support their Islamic view. And of course, they make challenges to the Christian faith as well, such as questioning the doctrine of the Trinity and questioning the deity of Christ and the fact that Jesus was crucified and the reliability of Scripture and so on. And so I became convicted that, you know, this is something that we need to really engage with, because obviously Islam is something which is a religion which is growing in number of followers, adherents, and also growing in influence in the world. And so I have I've sought to become acquainted with the Muslim sources and the common Islamic polemics and apologetics, and I've participated in various debates with Muslims over the years, and my interest has grown since getting acquainted with that during my university years.
All right. So, Jonathan, in your view, what would be the weakest arguments that the Islamic apologists bring, and what would be their strongest arguments?
Their weakest argument. There's so many weak arguments.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, you probably, I know you've encountered through the webinar that you participated in, the polemic that Muhammad has found in the Bible, which has got to be probably their weakest argument. Unfortunately, right, for Muslims, they are actually forced to adopt that position, because the Quran in Surah 7, verse 157, tells us that Muhammad is actually found in the pages of the Bible, and the Christians can read about Muhammad prophesied in the Bible. And so that's a real challenge, because it really commits you to finding him somewhere. What the text of the Quran says is that those who follow the messenger, the unlettered prophet, whom they find written in what they have of the Torah and the gospel, who enjoins upon them what is right and forbids them what is wrong and makes lawful for them the good things that prohibits them the evil and relieves them of their burden, the shackles which were upon them, and so on. But it says that they find the unlettered prophet written in what they have of the Torah and the gospel. And so Christians and Jews should be able to look back at the Torah and indeed the Injil, that is the gospel, and find Muhammad. And so Muslims have searched high and low. They've had 14 centuries to find Muhammad in the Bible. And unfortunately for them, they have not found anything which is even remotely resembling Muhammad in the Bible. One common popular example that they like to give is in John 14.
Right.
And they're kind of forced to use this text and indeed abuse this text because it is the only example in the Gospels where Jesus actually predicts someone to come after him. And so if Muhammad is in the Gospel, it has to be this one, really. And what the text says in John 14, we read at verse 15 following, "If you love me, mm-hmm. you will keep my commandments. And I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper to be with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you."
Right.
And the Muslim argument is that this is speaking about Muhammad, and it doesn't refer to the Holy Spirit, which is the traditional Christian interpretation, which seems to be the natural interpretation of this passage. The problem and they argue that the word parakletos is actually a corruption of parakletos, and really it refers to the exalted one, which is Muhammad, rather than to the helper or the comforter. The problem with that argument, of course, is that the audience to whom Jesus was communicating is the disciples. And so he says that he dwells with you, namely the disciples, not people living in Arabia 6 centuries later, and he will be in you. That doesn't make any sense unless it's referring to a spirit rather than a human being such as Muhammad. So that's a problem. And also Jesus, according to John 14 says that he asks the Father and he sends another helper. And then we read in John 16 that in verse 7, "Nevertheless, I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the helper will not come to you. But if I go, I will send him to you." So here's another problem. If we're equating the paraclete with Muhammad, and according to Islam, Muhammad is sent by Allah, but according to John's gospel, the paraclete is sent by Jesus. Who does that make Jesus? That makes him Allah, right? So it's a self-referentially refuting claim, because if you actually use this text consistently, then you end up with Jesus being God, because Jesus identifies himself as the one who sends the helper. So that's a problem with that. And just very briefly, one of the other popular passages that Muslims like to use is Deuteronomy 18, which is one of the classic ones from the Old Testament. We read about the prophet, like unto Moses, that God was to raise up. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers, to him you shall listen." And Muslims argue this is referring to Muhammad, and brothers, of course, refers to Ishmaelites, because Ishmael was the brother of Isaac. The problem is that brothers is actually defined in the same passage just a little bit earlier. If you read verse 1 of Deuteronomy 18, "Levitical priests, all the tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's food offerings as their inheritance. They shall have no inheritance among their brothers." And brothers there clearly refers to fellow kinsmen, fellow Israelites, rather mm-hmm. than Ishmaelites.
Yep.
And finally, to put the nail in the coffin for this one, Muslims typically try to argue that John 1 lends support to their interpretation, because in John 1, the Jews approach John the Baptist and they inquire as to his identity. They say, "Who are you?" He confessed, this is verse 20 of John 1, "He confessed and did not deny, but confessed, I am not the Christ. And they asked him, what then, are you Elijah? He said, I am not. Are you the prophet? He answered, no. And so the Muslim apologist argues, well, clearly the Jews actually distinguish between the Christ and the prophet, and so they're not the same individual. The problem is, why on earth are the Jews asking John the Baptist, a fellow Jew, as to whether he is the prophet? Because obviously, for the Muslim argument to work, he has to be an Ishmaelite. And the Muslim will come back and say, well, they were mistaken about this. They made a mistake. Well, then why can't I understand that the Jews made a mistake about distinguishing between the Christ and the prophet? So you can't have your cake and eat it at that point.
Yeah. In fact, I don't want to mention the gentleman's name because he's not here to defend himself. But one Muslim apologist began to interact in the webinar and raise questions about Isaiah 42 trying to point to Muhammad. And I agreed to debate him on it, but I said, really, I think you may want to take a different subject because it's really not a fair debate. And we've agreed to do one. There's another Muslim I agreed to debate as well on similar issues. But he said, okay, we debate Isaiah 42 and we debate Deuteronomy 18. I thought, why in the world would you want to debate these? You know, it'd almost be like me, you've got your British heavyweight champion now, Anthony Joshua, then I'm going to challenge him to a boxing match. I mean, why? Take something where you got a little bit of shot at it. All right, we'll be right back with Jonathan McClatchy.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown with my guest, Christian apologist Jonathan McClatchy. Jonathan, I've debated rabbis, counter-missionaries over the years about God's triunity and the deity of Yeshua, deity of Jesus. And in doing so, what I can do is rely on the Hebrew Bible and draw my arguments from there and say, hey, we can limit it entirely to the Hebrew Scriptures. And I could also draw on rabbinic tradition to build a bridge to some of the concepts. Obviously, debating a Muslim on it would be very different because they wouldn't be accepting the authority of the Hebrew Scriptures as we have them. And, of course, rabbinic literature would be of no use. So when you're debating something like that, that to me would be a more challenging one than debating Muhammad in the Old Testament, simply because we don't have as much common ground. And they can just say, well, the Trinity is confusing or something like that. So what do you feel is the best approach when debating these issues, the Trinity, deity of Jesus, with a Muslim?
Well, one might want to highlight the Quranic representations, or rather misrepresentations, of the doctrine of the Trinity. For example, Surah 4, verse 171 in the Quran says, do not say three, stop it, that is good for you. Allah is the only one God. He is far too pure to have a son. And so obviously, it says do not say three there. It doesn't say do not say Trinity, which is what some translations, such as the Yusuf Ali translation, render it. But if you say don't say three because there's only one, what are you doing? You're putting the two in the same category. And obviously, we as biblical Trinitarian monotheists do not believe that we do not think that there are three gods. We believe that there's one divine being and three divine persons. And so the Quran actually misrepresents the doctrine of the Trinity at that particular point. Surah 6, verse 101, moreover, says, he is the originator of the heavens and the earth. How can he have a son when he never had a wife? He created everything and he knows everything. Now, obviously, as Christians, we don't believe that Allah has taken to himself a wife and begotten his son Jesus. That's not the Christian belief, but that's what the Quran represents us as saying. Or Surah 573. Surely disbelievers are those who say Allah is a third of three, while there is no God but one God. Obviously, again, it's equating the doctrine of the Trinity with tritheism, which is not what the doctrine has ever maintained. And verse 75 of that same chapter says, the Messiah, son of Miriam, is no more than a messenger. There be messengers before him. His mother was very truthful. Both of them used to eat food. Look how we explain signs to them and see how far they are turned away. And then that obviously raises the question, why would it say that Mary would eat food? Surely that should be obvious. And you continue reading into the context, and you get to verse 116, when it says, when Allah said, O Isa, that's Jesus, son of Miriam, did you say to the people, take me and my mother as gods beside Allah? He said, pure are you, it does not behoove me to say what is not right for me. Had I said it, you would have known it. You know what is in my heart, and I do not know what is in yours. You alone have full knowledge of all that is unseen. And so it seems to me that the Quran seems to have this confused notion of the Christian concept of the Trinity, which equates it with Allah, Jesus, and Mary. This actually, although it doesn't explicitly, expressly equate the Trinity with Allah, Jesus, and Mary, that particular verse actually led the earliest biographer of Muhammad, Ibn Ishaq, in his Sirat al-Zu'ala in the mid-8th century to equate the Trinity explicitly with Allah, Jesus, and Mary. He, speaking of the Christians, he said, they argue that it is the third of three in that God says, we have done, we have commanded, we have created, and we have decreed. And they say, if he were one, he would have said, I have done, I have created, and so on. But he is he and Jesus and Mary, concerning all these assertions, the Quran came down. And so that seems to give us an insight into how the early Muslims understood the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. You can also look
In other words, just to make sure our listeners have this, that their perception, based on misunderstanding of Christian doctrine and perhaps some of the iconography of Catholics or others they would have run into, was that the Trinity was Father, Son, and Mary. That's basically how they conceived it, and that's what they were combating in the Quran.
Mm-hmm, exactly. You've also got the concept of Tawheed in Islam is interesting, because the typically in a Tawheed versus Trinity debate, in which I participated in several such debates with Muslims, and typically the Muslim will come equipped and prepared to talk about the doctrine of the Trinity and highlight apparent problems with the Trinity, whereas they rarely come prepared and equipped to defend the Islamic concept of Tawheed. And in fact, there are numerous problems that abound for the concept of Tawheed. One philosophical problem is, of course, that love is an essential quality of God, right? God is essentially loving, but he's not essentially creating. It's possible that God might not create, he might freely choose not to create, but he is essentially loving. And so then that obviously raises the question as to who was the object of God's love before creation. Obviously, the doctrine of Tawheed would maintain that God is not dependent upon his creation. And Muslims will typically respond and say, well, surely mercy is an essential quality as well. Has God been merciful to the other members of the Trinity? Whereas I would argue that that mercy is actually an expression of love rather than the essential quality, just as wrath is an expression of righteousness rather than the essential quality itself. Moreover, Richard Swinburne, a Christian philosopher, has argued that if God is the greatest conceivable being, as St. Anselm told us, then if there's a unique best action, God must do that action. If there's a unique best quality or kind of action, God must do an action of that quality or kind. Introducing a third divine person introduces a new quality of goodness, namely cooperation and sharing that goodness with another, whereas introducing a fourth divine person introduces a new fundamental quality of goodness. And so three is the best number for maximizing divine greatness, because a fourth person would be superfluous and God would no longer be a necessary being. There's also Quranic challenges to Tawheed. I mean, the Quran actually never affirms Unitarianism. It affirms monotheism, but it never actually affirms Unitarianism. Now, there's the doctrine of the Quran says that we cannot ascribe partners to Allah. That would be to commit the doctrine of shirk. Yet the Quran also teaches us, it seems to contradict this on occasion. For example, there's the doctrine of the divine spirit in Islam. So Allah is the creator of life. He's the sole creator of life. For example, Surah 15:23 tells us it is we, this is Allah, and only we who gives life and brings death, and we are the ultimate inheritor. We read that Allah creates life by a certain mechanism, namely breathing his spirit. And Surah 21:91, for example, remember her who protected her private parts. We blew in her through our spirit and made her and her sign a sign for all the worlds. Or Surah 66:12 says the same thing, that Allah creates Jesus by breathing of his spirit. We read in Surah 19, Surah Maryam, named after the Virgin Mary, that the Holy Spirit actually took upon himself the form of a perfect human being and announced that he was going to bestow upon her a boy. And so this creates a problem, because you have Allah creating by breathing his spirit, and the spirit turns out to be a personal agent who actually speaks to Mary and actually announces that he is going to bestow upon her a boy, using the Arabic word wahaba, which means to grant, to bestow, to present, etc.
Tell you what, I've got to jump in here. This is fascinating stuff, and for many listening, brand new information. I'm going to ask Jonathan to stay over with us into this next half hour and give us some practical guidelines on sharing the gospel with Muslims. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I have a special guest with me on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, Christian apologist Jonathan McClatchy, who's engaged in many debates, dialogues with Muslims in England. Jonathan, great to have you today on the line of fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown.
Let me ask you a quick question. We did a webinar a few weeks back for me Saturday afternoon, for you Saturday night, where I talked for a while on Messianic prophecy and then fielded questions. And it ended up that an Islamic apologist joined in and raised questions and we interacted further. What kind of feedback have you gotten to that? This is a neat thing you do with different apologists and folks from different backgrounds can join in, ask their questions. What kind of feedback did you get to that event?
Yeah, people very much enjoyed your webinar, actually. I heard a number of people say that it was the best webinar, actually, we had so far. And I know Dr. James White commented on it on his Dividing Line program. And it was certainly a very good presentation. And we very much appreciated having you on and the interaction that you had with us. We call it the Apologetics Academy. And basically, we bring on different scholars and apologists and personalities each Saturday at 8 p.m. UK time, which is 3 p.m. Eastern. And we have them basically present on a topic of interest to Christians, particularly on topics pertinent to questions such as, is Christianity actually true? And we also cross-examine and evaluate other worldviews. And I don't just bring on Christian scholars. I also often bring on atheists or sometimes even Muslim scholars, and we have them present their arguments, give a short opening presentation, and then we field questions from the floor. And so it gives opportunity for Christians to practice their debate if we're talking to a non-Christian skeptic, or and so we simulate a real-life situation, or alternatively, we can have Christians we can give Christians access to a scholar or apologist that they don't otherwise have access to, and they can get their questions addressed, and they can have one-on-one interaction with them, and then we can move on to someone else. And so it really allows us to unpack different issues in a lot of depth.
Yeah, and we posted the video, which, again, was an online substitute of Skype kind of thing. We posted on our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown, the entire, whatever it was, 2.5 hours or more of material. We posted. Jonathan, if folks want to find out about this or potentially get involved, where do they go?
If you go to my website, which is apologetics-academy.org, and click on online apologetics training, or if you go to apologetics-academy.org/online-training, that will take you to the upcoming schedule for the speakers that we have this coming Saturday. And we have Dr. Lydia McGrew coming on, and Lydia McGrew is going to talk to us about undesigned coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. So we're looking forward to having her on.
All right. We've got 1 minute to answer this, and then I want to ask you some questions about practical tips for sharing the gospel with Muslims. But 1 minute or less, are you ever afraid that bringing skeptics on, bringing non-believers on, will raise doubts and questions? Or are you confident that we have the truth to answer these?
I am confident that we have the truth to answer these. I mean, I operate with the philosophy that if Christianity is true, then we don't have anything to fear from honest inquiry and critical scrutiny. So I brought on, for example, in the past, atheist David Fitzgerald, who is a Jesus mythicist. And then we had him present to us on why he thinks Jesus never existed. And then in the audience, we had some really top scholars, like Dr. Timothy McGrew, for example, was there and others. And we had some really great interaction. And I think that we really demonstrated through that webinar just how difficult it is to actually defend the Jesus mythicist position. Because I thought that Fitzgerald was really on the back foot throughout that webinar. I've had Matt Dillahunty on in the past. I've had Aaron Ratt on, and other atheists. I've got Dr. Robert Fry scheduled in the future.
Excellent. So, all right, friends, apologetics-academy.org. When you get there, just click on the online training. Or if it's .com, we'll get you the right site. We'll be right back.
Fire we want, for fire we please. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and we often focus on the Middle East and Islam as well on a Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is something that I've looked at more in terms of Muslim outreach. We have grads from our ministry school serving in Muslim nations, some places I can't even say where they are because of the dangerous situations in which they find themselves. It's been in our heart for many years to reach the Muslim world. I'm talking about going right in the heart of it. One of our fire missionaries serving in Nigeria with a children's school is constantly teaching Muslim children and sharing the love of Jesus with Muslim families in a region not far from Boko Haram. We've got courageous folks out there. At the same time, we continue to sound alarm against radical Islam and urge America and the West to recognize the dangers. So it's both and for us. I'm speaking with Jonathan McClatchy. His website, apologetics-academy.org. And if you just scroll down on the page, you'll see online apologetics training. Click on that to find out about the Saturday seminars. Jonathan, before we get to some practical thoughts in terms of reaching Muslims with the gospel, and obviously the purpose of debate is not simply to defend our views, but to reach others, to get others to think practically. And I know you could go on at length, but we'll just get kind of soundbite answers. Now that you have a Muslim mayor of London, does that speak of radical changes in your country? Does that speak of Islam incrementally seeking to take over the nation, or is that an alarmist mentality?
I mean, obviously there are some Muslims who would like to do that, but I certainly don't think it's all Muslims or even most Muslims who are of that mentality. So certainly Islam is on the rise in the UK, that's for sure, and Islam is steadily increasing, and Islam is becoming more and more influential in the UK. There's Sharia law tribunals, for example, and Islam is certainly becoming more influential. Certainly in the universities I've attended, the Islamic Society is often bigger than the Christian Union. So certainly Islam is becoming bigger and more influential. How that will manifest itself 5-10 years down the line, I think is difficult to say.
Yeah, well, what about this, though? Christians want to evangelize, share the gospel, make disciples of the nations. Islam does, but in a different way, in that Islam is calling for submission to Allah and the imposition of Sharia law. So wouldn't this be a logical strategy to take more and more and more ground to implement Sharia within Islamic communities and ultimately to get to some point where there's a majority or enough presence to impose it on the nation?
As I said, certainly some Muslims are of that mentality. For example, Anjem Chowdhury, who is a well-known London Muslim cleric, would like to do that, and he would like to impose and implement Sharia law upon the UK, and that's his agenda, and it's the agenda of other Muslims too. But I don't think that I would say that's the, but certainly in the with respect to the Muslims that I've encountered, I wouldn't say that's the majority mentality.
Got it. All right. I appreciate the fair answer. And then this is not Thoroughly Jewish Thursday subject matter, but since you're on the air, I've got to ask you, and again, just the soundbite answer, what's your personal feeling about Brexit?
My personal feeling is, it's a complex matter for sure, and there's certainly pros and cons on both sides. I personally would be pro-Remain, but I can see where both sides are coming from.
And do you think that there are major implications for the nation in the days ahead now that the decision has been made?
For sure. It's difficult to know exactly how that is going to unravel. The economy took a major hit because of the uncertainty. That's an immediate consequence of the decision. But it's difficult to say at this point exactly. Certainly the UK is still part of the EU for another 2 years to come. So it's not immediately separated at this point.
Got it. All right. So back to, I appreciate the answers. And I really have so little insight on this whole issue, except for just having to wonder what's going to happen to the people that were basing their prophetic scenarios on a 10-nation European Union and allegedly finding prophecies of it in the Book of Revelation. I kind of wonder what happens with that, but we shall see. All right, you're the average Muslim that we're going to speak to in America, or you're going to speak to in the UK, is not trying to blow you up, is not a terrorist going around with a machete looking for someone to behead. You have some Muslims who are more devoted than others and some who are very sympathetic to Islamic terror. But let's just say your neighbor, friend, they identify as Muslim. They feel very strongly about being Muslims. They may not pray five times a day, but they probably fast during Ramadan and things like that. You want to share the gospel with them. What would you give as basic tips, either what to do or what not to do?
Sure. I would want to communicate to them, the doctrine of human depravity, first of all, obviously in Islam, we're created basically good, whereas in Christianity, we're actually, we have the doctrine of original sin, that we're all sinful by nature. And so we need to clarify that. We need to contrast it with God's holiness and look at the concept of justice in Islam, because justice obviously is an expression of God's holiness, his righteousness. And in Islam, God can basically turn a blind eye to sin. For example, there's a hadith narration in Sahih Bukhari, which tells us about a man who'd murdered 99 men, and he's looking about asking how his repentance can be received and accepted. And he comes to a monk, and he asks the monk, and the monk says, sorry, you can't be forgiven. And so he murders the monk, and so now he's slaughtered 100 men. And so he's continuing asking, and someone eventually tells him to go to a certain village where his repentance can be accepted. But on the way, the time for his death comes, and so the good and bad angels come to argue over his soul, and Allah rules that if he's closer to the town he was going to, then he'd be forgiven. And so Allah causes the earth to shrink, so he's one cubit closer to the city he was going to, and so he's forgiven. And so that's the concept of justice in Islam. There was no justice dispensed for the 100 men that this man had killed. Whereas in Christianity, by contrast, no sin is ever forgiven. It's the sinner that's forgiven. The sin is dealt with to the just degree, either on the head of the sinner or on the head of the sinless substitute, namely Jesus Christ. And so I would want to look at the concept of justice and how in Christianity alone do God's compassion, his love, his mercy come together and meet hand in hand with his justice and his integrity and his holiness. And it's only in view of the cross of Christ that we can actually reconcile those doctrines, because God is the greatest conceivable being, and so God must manifest the attributes which are maximally great. And obviously love and justice are great making qualities, and it's only in the cross of Christ that those qualities come together.
And when you speak to a Muslim, obviously you're conveying things in very eloquent terms and in theological terms. As you're breaking them down for the person you're speaking with, and they have to deal with the fact of their own sinfulness, do Muslims in general have a view of themselves as righteous, good people, or as people who sin and are in need of forgiveness?
Certainly there's a need for forgiveness. Concept in Islam, and Muslims consider themselves in need of forgiveness. Even Muhammad, according to the Quran, needed to repent. So Muhammad was certainly a sinner as well, even though a lot of Muslims have a view that Muhammad was sinless. That seems to contradict what the Quran tells us. Many Muslims will accept that they are sinful and in need of forgiveness. There's a concept in Islam of scales, and everyone's born with a set of scales, and there's a good and bad angel on your shoulders that are weighing up and taking note of your good and your bad deeds, and these are ultimately weighed against each other. And if you're more righteous than you are sinful, then you can be granted entry into Jannah or paradise. But obviously in Islam, there's actually no guarantee of salvation. Even Muhammad wasn't guaranteed salvation according to the Quran. And Abu Bakr, his closest companion, and indeed his father-in-law, father of Aisha, his child bride, Abu Bakr said, even if I had one foot in paradise, even then I would still fear Allah's deception, according to the hadith narrations. And so there's no concept of eternal security. which is another beauty of Christianity, where I believe as a Christian that we do have eternal security. And so that's something I would communicate as well.
Yeah, and the whole idea of knowing that you can know that you know that your sins are forgiven. I'll never forget a conversation I had, Jonathan, with a Muslim driver. It was just a driving service driving me to the airport. And I found it was a Muslim. We began to talk. And I asked him, is he devout? Yes. Does he do this? Does he do that? You know, just upholds the pillars of Islam. Yes, yes. I said, so you're sure when you die, you go to paradise? He said, 50-50. 50-50. Think of it. Think of living your whole life. And that's it. All right. Got one more segment with Jonathan McClatchy. His website, apologetics-academy.org.
Join Dr. Michael Brown along with Messianic Jewish pastor Scott Volk for a unique behind-the-scenes tour of Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. Space is limited, so we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip and to secure your spot, please visit our website at AskDrBrown.org and click on the Israel Tour banner or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I do hope you can join me in Israel next year for the tour of a lifetime. Go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. to find out more. All right, I've just got a few more minutes with Jonathan McClatchy. Thanks for staying on with us the better part of this hour. Allow me to switch subjects on you once more. Because you have so much academic training in biology and cellular biology and things like that, obviously you've looked at works like Stephen Meyer's Signature of the Cell and other things like that. Even though it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, I want to deviate from our subject matter and ask you, in your academic study, what has been most awe-inspiring as you study biology, study cellular biology? What has most struck you in terms of arguments for the existence of an intelligent designer, of a creator, through your academic studies in science?
Well, that's a great question. There's so many examples to pick from. I mean, certainly the information-bearing properties of DNA and RNA for me is really compelling as an argument for design, because obviously there's a habitual association in our cause and effect experience between information content and conscious activity. And so when we find information intrinsic to the hereditary molecules of DNA and RNA, it follows that the most causally adequate explanation is that it arose by virtue of an intelligent agency, just as if we were looking at the hieroglyphic inscription or the pages of the paragraphs in the pages of a book, we would infer design by virtue of the specified complexity that is conveyed there. And by specified complexity, of course, I mean a phenomenon or pattern which is complex, and by complex I mean improbable, so improbable that it exhausts the probabilistic resources at one's disposal, and it also is specified. So by specified, I mean it conforms to some independently given pattern, just as, say, if you dial in a four-digit PIN number to your ATM machine, that PIN number is a specified complexity because it's specific to your bank card. So it's not only improbable, but it's also specified. And that's what we find in DNA. And DNA, of course, does many things. It's involved in gene control and regulation, and also specifies the sequential ordering or arrangement of amino acid subunits that form proteins. And proteins are basically the toolkit of the cell. And there's different proteins that are crafted in different ways to perform different tasks in the cell. They might form parts of molecular machines, or they might form enzymes that that participate in biochemical pathways. And the ratio or the prevalence of functional and stable protein structures within the vast array of combinatorial possibilities or ways of arranging amino acids seems to be astronomically small if you look at the scientific literature. And then when it comes to actually explaining macromolecular machines which require multiple such proteins to cooperate in concert, then the probabilities multiply exponentially. And that, to me, is a really powerful argument for design. When you look at the wonders of DNA replication machinery or the wonders of, say, the bacterial flagellar motor and the way that the bacterial flagellar motor is assembled within the cell, the way it's, the sequential ordering of the expression of the different gene products as the flagellar motor is put together is absolutely mind-boggling. And it strains credulity to say that this could possibly be put together by some neo-Darwinian stochastic type of mechanism. Mm. So, yeah.
So Jonathan, I presume that many of the professors under whom you've studied have been non-believers. And yet my reading of this as a non-scientist is that it does strain credulity to try to explain DNA, RNA any other way, or some of these other things you're getting into that the complexity is beyond me. It seems to strain credulity to explain these other ways. Did you ever have the opportunity, we've only got 2 minutes, but to ask any of these professors who were maybe agnostics or atheists if it didn't strain their own credulity to believe these things?
I tend to not be very confrontational in the university setting because I don't like to, you know, present myself as a peer to a professor or supervisor. In that way. But I mean, in my undergraduate, I did have a conversation with an immunologist I was studying under about the complement system, the complement cascade, which is a very complex and sophisticated mechanism involved in immunology. And I asked him whether, you know, this seemed to be the type of mechanism that could be constructed in a neo-Darwinian fashion, and he had no idea how it could have come together in that way.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Yeah, well, Jonathan, I'm sure all of this learning you'll continue to marshal for the cause of the gospel. And obviously it's the power of the Holy Spirit that opens a sinner's heart to the Lord. It's God's mercy that's poured in that turns them. And yet many times as we reason together, people are willing now to hear the rest of the messages. C.S. Lewis intellectually went from atheist to theist and then by the Spirit was converted. So it's a both and. And even for Christians, to help us love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, having our mind renewed to these truths is wonderful. And again, as a non-scientist, my impression is the more science learns, the harder it's going to be to deny God the Creator. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Romans 1, 20 is far more true now than it was when Paul wrote it.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not just dealing with where did the thunder and lightning come from. You're dealing with where did this complex information come from. I remember talking to a Filipino doctor, a woman who did brain surgery. And I was talking to her about how much we understand about the brain. She said, oh, almost nothing. And I said, the more you get into it, do you see that it's complex? Or it turned out she was a Christian, and she's just in awe of God the more she studies the brain. So, Jonathan, thanks for using your brain for the glory of God and being a blessing to our listeners. Hopefully some of them will join you at the Apologetics Academy in the future. God bless you, dear brother.
Thank you, Dr. Brown.
All right. So go to apologetics-academy.org, apologetics-academy.org. Check out the resources there and then scroll down for online training. You can be part of the weekly webinar with top scholars, with non-believing scholars as well, interacting. You'll find it very, very fruitful. So again, appreciate the great work that Jonathan is doing. And be sure to visit our website. We are constantly adding new articles and new videos. As I was flying back from Australia, I wrote an article that's gone somewhat viral this week, and then wrote another article day after I got back, and then just wrote another article this morning. New videos we're putting out all there on the website, plus our special resource offer at Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, speak the truth with confidence to atheists, Muslims, believers, non-believers of every stripe. We're on the side of truth in Jesus.